upon their arrival was almost unspeakable.
We brought all evil into some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to the Bad Taste Crime Cast. I'm Janelle.
I'm Vicky.
And we're going to take you on a tour of murder. But first, what do we got, Vicky?
I don't know how I feel about this voice you're doing right now.
I'm doing some sort of boat sort of tour voice, like,
oh my God.
And to the left,
and to the left, you will see our crumbling democracy.
A bag full of bodies.
Oh, no.
No.
See those trash bags? All body parts.
Yes.
Welcome back. If this is your first time listening, a special hello to you. I'm very excited about today's episode for a lot of very special reasons. I got myself a new, we'll say, desk accessory that will probably, you'll figure it out.
You already told me what it was.
When it happens. I'm saying
it.
For the listener. For the listener, when it happens, you'll know.
Yeah.
For sure. It's loud as hell. What else? I think that's, is that all?
It's our the holidays. Banter? Congratulations on making it this far. Soon it's going to be the roaring 20s all over again.
Is this our last one of the year? Like our last one before New Year's?
No, I think we got one more.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure. I think we did three in December.
No, I think this is the, because.
When does this one come out?
Yeah.
Okay, this is the 29th. This is after the Christmas.
Yeah. So this is our last one before New Year's.
Yes.
Last one of 2019.
Oh, Mew Mew.
Resident Kitten just came in because she was like, yo, last episode of 2019. What?
Yeah. Meow. She's like, I'm ready for the 20s. New decade. New me.
New me.
Aww. New decade. New me.
So that's also pretty exciting. We made it through another year. Thank goodness.
I mean, but did we?
Almost.
Are we in another universe?
I mean, technically, we haven't quite made
is
it through
this a hologram?
2019 yet. Are you a hologram?
Did we actually die in 2012 and this is a projection?
Oh my God, stop it. That's too much Matrix.
I know.
Well,
save that for another episode.
Yes. Let's head over to the newsroom. So this week we're in Brazil. Not literally in Brazil, but our news is in Brazil.
I mean, that would be interesting if we were in Brazil.
So we're going to talk about a good son and what a good son does.
Not the movie with Elijah Wood and Macaulay Culkin.
No, not that one. No. No. But you might say a good son would try to pass his mother's driving test for her.
Okay.
Maybe?
I'm seeing some Monty Python-esque skits coming in now.
Yeah, right. Well, whatever you're imagining, it's exactly true.
Okay.
His name is Heider Chiave. His mother, Maria, 60 years old. She had failed her driving test three times. This comes from the BBC. Mm-hmm. So he decided to dress up as his mother, and I am talking the full deal. Let me see. I don't know
Sounds
if you can
legit.
See it from there, but
is that him?
That's him. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Flower blouse, did his hair, he painted his nails, did his makeup, the whole nine yards.
I mean, the look's pretty spot on.
Yeah.
I'm sure he got caught when it came to the voice.
Well, they said, there was an instructor that said, quote, he tried to be as natural as possible. He wore lots of makeup with his nails nicely done and wore women's jewelry. But yeah, pretty quickly they were like, I don't know if this is the same person. That's on, not even that it was a man.
There's a 5 o'clock shadow on you.
But just generally that it wasn't the same person in the ID.
Yeah.
So they called police. He was arrested for driving school fraud and misuse of someone's identity and confessed right away because he was just trying to
Can't help him.
I mean, yeah. Yeah. His mom didn't know that he was going to do that either.
Of course not.
He just decided to go and do it himself.
She would have like hit him with a shoe or something. Like, don't,
what are you doing?
People.
Quack, quack, quack. Yeah. So, you know, good Samaritans getting arrested.
Good try.
Yeah, it's like, it's one of these things. It's like, I know it's totally a waste of like public resources and time to be arresting them. You know what I mean? Because it's like, mm-hmm. why waste the resources? But at the same time, it's kind of sweet doing this thing for your mom. I mean.
And the DMV, I mean, they're frauds, so it's fine.
Well, at least the U.S. I don't know if it's better or
Illinois.
Worse.
Illinois.
Yeah, right. I don't know if it's better or worse in Brazil.
I just got the like notification to renew my my license plate sticker. So,
girl, I just got a new car.
I'm about
yeah.
I had it with the DMV yeah. service.
It was like, oh my god, got a new car. So then you had to pay for license and registration fees. Mm-hmm. Oh my god, just sucking money out of my wallet. We're yeah. not going to go into that, but. It was not a pleasant time that day.
It never is.
A lot. It was like, bye-bye. We're going to head over to Netflix and Kill. And this week, the only thing that we could be talking about, really, I think.
The only thing? You don't want to talk about the weird Christmas movies on Netflix?
No. Unless they're murdery? No.
I mean, I'd feel like one. I want to murder after I watch stuff like that. But.
No, we're talking about The Confession Killer.
Of course.
I was very excited. The trailer came out around Thanksgiving. We were recording at that time. And so I was like, the instant it came out, it took like 2 days, I think, to get through it. Mm-hmm. You have watched it, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So for those that haven't, first of all, spoiler alerts. Second of all, you should already know about this case, I think.
Yeah.
It's kind of a big deal. So it is the story of Henry Lee Lucas, who is an alleged serial killer. Supposedly, it spanned from 1960 to 1983. Total, he was convicted of murdering 11 people, and he did receive a death sentence for what they called Orange Sox, the Orange Sox murder. It was the murder of Deborah Jackson, but the documentary really delves into this question of whether he had actually murdered all the people that he had confessed about, which was somewhere in the 200s.
Yeah, or anyone at all.
Right, right. Except for his mother.
Yes. Which confirmed
he,
kill.
Yeah, that one was confirmed, and he was convicted and did his time for that. Which, again, is like, I can't believe those sentences were short enough that he would be out in his lifetime. But sure. I think he was, like, a kid, though, when
yeah.
it happened. Mm-hmm. So he shows up. The guy is, like, I'm pretty sure if you were to imagine somebody as a serial killer, he is what they would look like. He has this kind of, like, droopy eye. He's missing teeth. He's kind of this scroungy looking.
You're just making fun of poor people in Texas.
I mean, but they even say in there, like, the guy was, like, what you would imagine. But at the yeah, same time.
Definitely creepy. Mm-hmm. And especially when they described often that his eye would leak.
Ew.
Nice. Like, that's not yeah. part of this.
But he shows up, starts confessing to murder after murder after murder. Once they, like, create a task force to what they say is facilitate the confessions, not necessarily to do the investigations, but because he was confessing for murders everywhere, like along the southern part of the United States, from coast to coast, yeah. essentially. And there was some question brought in about police techniques using the interrogations.
Mm-hmm. Or lack of techniques.
Or lack of techniques.
Lack of smoothness. Mm-hmm. Here's a case file. Read it over. It's like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. And even some of the, like, ways he would have gotten information to take them to sites where he was saying there were bodies or where murders mm-hmm. happened. Later, he came out and said it was all a lie. There is a ton of evidence that points to him being in other places. And even, like, at other murders during the time that he was supposedly murdering some of these other people. Uh-huh. But
there were people showing back up alive.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yeah. And then not. Mm-hmm. Like, Becky?
Yeah. She's alive. Wait, is she alive?
Yeah.
Who is
yeah,
this?
That's a whole. It's yeah. The story on a whole is interesting.
Because my boyfriend didn't know anything about this, and I started watching it with him, and he got so confused. I'm like, that's the point of this. It's back and forth and back and forth, and you don't know what is truth and what is fiction.
It's one of these, like, there's a lot that went wrong at one time mm-hmm. in order for this to happen.
And even when people were definitively bringing proof, like, there were detectives who were putting together fake cases.
Right.
Just to prove the fact that he doesn't know anything and that this is all just, like, one big system feeding in on mm-hmm. itself.
The other factor you got to think about, too, is this was largely being handled by the Texas Rangers, mm-hmm. which, as an organization itself, does have a reputation to uphold right. as the law enforcement people of the South, like mm-hmm. they touch on that in the series, kind of this reputation that they had gotten for being tough lawmen.
Yeah.
And I think it's for them and for other police agencies that were investigating these crimes, sometimes until you get a new guard of people in, it's hard to acknowledge failures of the past. Mm-hmm. And many don't want to, because it does also mean more work and opening cases and reinvestigating and allocating more resources to that. But it doesn't do anybody any good to continue to, like, support these convictions.
Yeah. And there are certain states where it's worse, like Texas mm-hmm. and California. That's why you hear so much news about those cases being turned over and things like that, because those two states in particular have a reputation of doing things like that, like trying to skirt failures or mishandlings.
Right.
That's like a whole conversation in and of itself. But I think that the ultimate goal for all of these departments is to seek justice.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not trying to do that, no matter what the consequence is, like, okay, somebody bungled something, but they're retired. They're done. It's right. It's over with.
Right.
So why not go back and fix it?
Right.
You know, you're not actually directly hurting anybody.
Yeah. And I will say there are agencies and police forces that had originally closed their cases because they had gotten a confession from Lucas. And there are some of those agencies have gone back and reinvestigated and were able to, you know, use newer technology like DNA mm-hmm. to figure out who the actual killer was and rectify those situations.
Yeah.
And I applaud those agencies for that mm-hmm. Because I think that is going to do more help. Because obviously, if he's confessing to these things that he didn't do, that person who actually did them is still
getting away with it.
Right. Is still out there. Mm-hmm. Possibly murdering more people. I know towards the end of the season, they get the confession from the older
actual murderer.
Yeah. And it was like 20 or 30 years later that they said, we found your DNA on a victim's underwear. Mm-hmm. And he came and they were able, like, that's good. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought it was well put together. I know one of your complaints a lot of times about series is that they're like they go on too long or they mm-hmm. stay on a topic too long. And I did not feel like.
No, this is actually pretty like quick.
Yeah, it was good. It was like four episodes, mm-hmm. four or five episodes.
But it didn't
good
feel
pace.
Like they were concentrating on one Mm-mm. thing.
Mm-mm. So check it out. It's called The Confession Killer. It's out on Netflix. If you need something like New Year's Eve to watch.
I don't remember that.
As you ring in 2020.
I don't know if that's the face you want to remember as you're, you know,
hey.
Singing Auld Lang Syne.
This is that part of the show where we say content is not appropriate for all listeners. I know I will be talking about murder. And
yeah. Mine's not gruesome, but yeah. There's definitely some children yeah. in it.
We're also going to be talking about some mental illness mm-hmm. and some things like that. So heads up on that. But
yes,
Janelle.
If you know anything about me, my other love besides murder.
Oh, is
one of my many loves.
Beekeeping
is dachshunds.
Oh yes,
and bright lipsticks, and also art.
Art.
I am an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to look at the very interesting intersection of art and crime, and not just like, you know, the basic ass stuff where it's like, oh, we're faking stuff to make it right. look like it's old or it was by somebody else. I'm talking actual bloodshed.
And I'll be honest, I was a little worried about this one because sometimes when you pick something, it sounds like it's narrow, but it's actually pretty broad. And this was one of those times. So I'm very excited.
People don't realize like the very artists are strange people.
No,
it's the only way I can say that in a polite way.
Can I bring up the banana duct tape thing that's been?
I mean, that's a whole nother conversation about the art market and museums and the guy eating it and art expos.
Oh my
and
gosh.
It's like art criticism. Like, I went on a tangent with someone about it. I had like a group of art educators and we talked about it a little bit. It's like ridiculous. Anyway, I'll do a whole episode on that by myself in my room.
That would be so funny.
To get it all out. but you don't realize how many artists are involved in shady and shifty things. Or, you know, getting into sword fights in the middle of a street over a prostitute. You know, things like that.
Although, I do feel like that if anybody was going to do that, it would be some artist somewhere.
Yes. So, exactly. And I run in
an artist or a dictator.
Exactly. I mean, what's the difference? I run in different circles of artists in the Midwest. And although all of them are different and they all do different things, there's still like these distinct personalities in each group. And I'm like, we're all the same people. But I am going to talk a little bit about Frank Lloyd Wright. Are you familiar with that name?
Yes. Perfect. I feel like he is a pretty big deal around here.
Around here, definitely. If you live in Illinois or Wisconsin or Iowa, you're definitely going to know who the fuck Frank Lloyd Wright is. Mm-hmm. If you live anywhere else, you might not. Although he is kind of famous in Japan a little bit.
When I first started going to college, I went to college near his home and studio in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. That was pretty cool.
Yes. Yeah. So he was an architect and an interior designer who originally hailed from Wisconsin. And he's a really prominent figure in the prairie style movement, which is kind of like out of the arts and crafts movement, which happened in the 19th, 20th century area. He was very, very, you know, Midwestern guy. It was a very Midwestern movement. It was bungalow houses. Like, think of your classic bungalow house. That was Frank Lloyd Wright.
Right.
You can still see a shit ton of his architecture around here in Illinois and Wisconsin. But some of his really famous homes include the Roby House, Falling Water, Kentuck Knob, and his most famous home, the Taliesin. And that is where our story will take place.
Okay.
It's like,
I feel like I need to look up a picture of this.
Yes. I think there's some at the bottom or in the middle.
Oh.
I put lots of pictures.
Okay. Let me scroll down then.
Yes. So I'm going to state a controversial statement because we are in the mecca of Frank Lloyd Wright, but he is a trash person.
Oh, coming in hot. Wait.
Coming in hot. Hot take. Yeah. Hot take. So Frank Lloyd Wright, or I'm going to call him F.L. Dubs. Okay. F.L. Dubs had like so many, 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 many mistresses.
Okay.
Like, a ton of mistresses.
I get the feeling I'm going to learn a whole lot about Frank Lloyd Wright that I never knew.
That you don't want to know.
Because I did not know that.
Right? You're just like, he makes pretty houses. but he also treated his staff pretty poorly. So these are, like, two key factors in the upcoming tale I'm going to tell you. He was marked by scandal many times, not just of a sexual nature, but also he was constantly in debt. And murder. Yeah.
Yeah, that a little murder I definitely thrown in there. Did not know at all.
Mm-hmm. So the New York Post described Wright in an article from 2017 as a house builder and a home wrecker.
That's a great. Like, I love that. I love that so much.
It's the most awesome thing I've ever heard. It's on the fucking nose. It's like everything Frank Lloyd is. So I read the book Death in a Prairie House for this, and it's a pretty interesting book. It's got a lot of prolific prose in it. It's very like poetic, but there's also really great chapter titles, and one of them is called The Architect and the Feminist, and that's just like it sucked me in. I was like, this story is amazing.
All right.
No one likes to talk about his dark side, because he's like this darling Midwestern architect. But mm-hmm. I feel it's really important to talk about the dark side of artists, because it informs their art and their work. Our lives are directly connected to our work.
Right.
Of course, this is like a huge conversation you can have if you should separate the art from the artist. But for this case, we're not going to separate the art from the artist because it's like all connected into this story.
Okay.
Hear me out. So F.L. Dubs was married to Catherine since 1889, and they had several children, and their marriage seemed to be okay, but by 1900 standards. So it's like, your husband's never home. You don't actually take care of your kids. There's a nanny.
Sounds great.
Everything's fine.
Sounds okay.
However, he was like a regular old bad boy, and he was out like doing liaisons left and right with all sorts of women.
I just had an image of him in like a motorcycle jacket, right? On a motorcycle.
With just like terrible half like sunglasses that just cover like the bottom of your eye.
Yeah, yeah.
But it really hadn't been an issue with Catherine. She's kind of like, boys will be boys, and let it slide a little bit, because it was like one-off sleep with a woman, not a relationship. Now, that didn't become an issue until Martha Boughton Borthwick Cheney, a.k.a. Mamay, entered the scene.
Is that what they called her?
Yes.
Mamay.
She was very into...
Mama? Is it Mama or Mamay?
Mamay.
Mamay.
It's like a French name that was given to her because she was very into all these kind of weird literature movements.
Okay.
Mamay actually met Catherine Wright first through activities in a social club. And Mamay was married to Edwin Cheney, which like their names are... I want to say Cheney, but it's not. It's Cheney.
It definitely looks like Janie.
Yeah. They had two children, and she was a very forward thinker. She was the feminist. That's where that whole The Architect and the Feminist chapter came out of. She was very, very well educated, and she was actually in the process of translating a Swedish philosopher's text. And it's Ellen Key is her name, even though it looks like Key, if you ever want to look her up. But there's this excerpt from her philosophy that I think kind of highlights the way Mamay was kind of infatuated with her. Side by side with the class war, the culture war must ceaselessly be waged by the young and among the young upon whom rests the responsibility of making the new society better from all than the old could be. So very much into like this kind of transcendental enlightenment, feminist forward thinking literature.
Yeah.
And she was translating this woman's text from Swedish to English.
Okay.
So she was not your normal mother and wife.
Yeah.
She was, you know, a philosopher in and of herself.
Especially at that time, like,
yeah,
having
not
any sort
really.
Of your own ideas mm-hmm. as a lady.
And other people being, you know, other people saying that she was considered intelligent and forward thinking.
Yeah.
That's kind of a huge statement.
Right.
After Mamay met Catherine, the Cheneys commissioned Frank Lloyd Wright to design a house for them in 1903. In 1908, just a few years later, after a romance begins to bud, after building the Cheney house between FLW and Mamay, Mamay's husband gave her a one-year test. He's like, you can do whatever you want with Frank Lloyd Wright for 1 year. And if your affections for him are truly genuine, or if they're just because you're in close proximity, we'll find out.
Yeah.
If it's just an infatuation or if you truly feel that way. So this is kind of like...
That's wild.
A weird
like
kind
an
of
open marriage situation,
a little
basically.
Bit.
Yeah.
Now, they weren't like boinking at this point, but there was a lot of like...
Yeah.
Trepid hand-holding.
Gotcha.
You know?
Yes. Very intense.
Very intense eye staring. A lot
oh God,
of, like,
no.
long walks around parlors.
I don't want intense eye staring in any part of my relationship.
So it was a lot of very, you know, PG-13 stuff. So after that year, Mamay's feelings had not changed. And so they were kind of deciding what they should do. And right, unfortunately for Catherine... as well, was very infatuated with Mamay. So Frank decided to leave Catherine and their six children And Mamet left her husband and their two children, and they began their unconventional relationship. They were kind of still married, but living together in sin.
Okay. Artists.
Yeah, oh my God. Catherine refused to give Frank a divorce. So this, like, whole charade was kind of, like, a big scandal. And this is what really kind of put, like, marked his name during this period. The two decided to kind of traverse Europe and see if everything would settle down. You know, when you're in a totally debaucherous, you know, scandalous relationship in the Victorian era, the only thing to do is to go to France.
Yeah.
The only thing you can do is go to France where it's acceptable.
Basically. I mean, they had the Moulin Rouge.
Exactly.
And the Can-Can girls.
And that's, you know, in French culture, having a mistress or, you know, a man on the side is totally fine. God. As long as your other significant other doesn't
come
find
on.
Out.
France.
So newspapers kind of began reporting on the two in gossip columns, and there was a lot of talk that Frank Lloyd Wright was going to be arrested if he came back to Europe from Europe for adultery, which I think is pretty hilarious.
Okay.
It never happened.
Did you get arrested for adultery at that time?
Oh yeah. More so often, it was women who got thrown into jail for adultery.
Of course it was.
But if it was a man of higher standing, like he was considered of higher standing, and he actually came from a kind of religious background.
Okay.
Which I'll discuss a little bit further in my thoughts. So he was kind of held to a higher caliber. So there was a lot of gossip that he might be arrested for it. Of course, nothing would have happened if he was arrested. They would have probably fined him and gave him a slap on the wrist and told him to divorce his fucking wife. Right. But that didn't happen. So they returned from Europe, and to seal their love, Wright decided to build the two lovers a mansion, and he called it the Tilesian. This is actually...
It's so posh.
It's such a, like, a Tilesian. Difficult thing to understand. Like, why did you fucking name it this way? Well, it is a very weird story. It involves a Welsh bard, poet, who sang poetry to a king in some weird era.
Okay.
And... whatever. More often people refer to it as their love castle or the love bungalow instead of the Tilesian.
I do not like either of those.
There's also several other ways that people have pronounced it, but for this one I'm going to call it the Tilesian, because that's the most common Midwest pronunciation there, of course.
And he's, you know, from here.
He's from here. That's how he called it. Right. That we're not fucking Welsh. It was also Welsh back in like 409 was the year, like something fucking ridiculous when writing was like,
we'll call it what we want because we are Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah.
Hey. So,
the scandal kind of greatly affected Wright's work. He didn't receive another major commission from 1911 to 1916. He was like not doing anything.
Okay.
So that's like a big deal. Now, there's a lot of conjecture as to why Wright decided to leave his completely comfortable situation for another woman and not just have, you know, a chick on the side. There was some talk that he enjoyed Mamet more and viewed her as an intellectual equal. And there was a lot of discussion that he was going through this midlife crisis and wanted to have someone that he could talk to on that intellectual level.
Okay.
Which, I mean, having a, you know, liaison with a woman and living with another woman while you're married is kind of like the midlife crisis equivalent of having a Ferrari in the Victorian times.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. But the biggest conspiracy surrounding this entire thing was that people believed he had a genetic predilection to wrecking his own life. Okay.
That's okay. I'm interested.
How do you quantify that?
Tell me more, Janelle. Please tell me more about how
a genetic connection.
How your genetics make you want to destroy your own life.
F.L. Dubb's father did the literally exact same thing.
Okay. So if that is true, I still
it
feel,
is true.
I mean,
there were newspaper reports about it.
I still feel like it would be like less genetic and maybe just learned behavior.
Well, there is a school of thought that when things happen to you that are traumatic, it affects your genetics.
Okay.
It's genetically transferred trauma. So, witnessing this, his father was deeply, deeply religious. He was a minister, okay? And he did this exact same thing, was married, had children, started seeing another woman,
okay,
and left them, didn't get a divorce. Like, the same timeline, he was the same age.
Yeah.
It was exactly the same.
Yeah.
Frank Lloyd Wright did not know his father. He didn't know what happened until much later in his life. And that was after pretty much the point of this already initiating. So that's why there is a school of thought that it was this sort of like genetic trauma that had happened to him that caused him to want to keep doing these things that harmed him. And he knowingly knew it would harm him, but did it anyway. So it's a lot of like psychoanalysis, a lot of these weird, like, traumatic theories. So I thought that was really interesting. I read an article about it, and I was like, really? So there's a couple different thoughts. Midlife crisis, he wanted someone who was equal to him intellectually, or, you know, it's this sort of genetic, inherited,
weird, life-wrecking trait. And I hate to say this, but it's very Scientology also. Mm-hmm. Like, they come from very similar origin, like, schools of thought.
Yeah.
That kind of genetic, it's like.
But it made me think of, like, whenever somebody says, when you grow up, you're going to turn out to be like your mother or your father. And you're like, no, I'm not. I'm not going to do that. I'm not a fucking crazy, weird, off the handle Italian woman. And then you're like, oh shit.
And then one day you look in the mirror. Yeah. One day you look in the mirror and you realize, I'm looking more crazy and Italian than normal.
So because I had that thought too, like, I never want to be like my parent because, you know, I don't have a great relationship with them. but when you come to a point of realizing that, that's when you break that sort of genetic trauma. And that is the whole basis of this. So he realized what he was doing, but didn't try to take the steps to change his behavior to break that pattern. And there's, you know, I'm sure you've seen the memes where it's like, we're just trying to heal our past traumas. Well, that's what that meme came out of, was that genetic traumatic theory. So there is an actual, like, scientific theory behind that fucking meme. We're all trying to heal our past traumas.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, there's if you think about, look back at your history, or if you ever try to research your ancestry and you find all of these stories and you think about the things that happened to your ancestors and the way that you react to things now, there is this kind of thread between, you know, your reactivity and what happened to them. So it's kind of an interesting thing to read about. And that's why I thought it was really weird that somebody brought this up for this particular person. I'm like, I don't know about that. But
part of me feels like I need to find out more stories of my ancestors now. Mm-hmm. To like, because literally the first thing that came to mind was a story that my mom used to tell me of my great-grandma or my great-great-grandma coming over from Germany and landing in like Texas or somewhere. Mm-hmm. And the first thing they saw when they got off of the boat was like a cow getting slaughtered. And my great grandma was like, I want to go home.
And I'm so thinking, you don't eat red meat.
I'm like, is that why I don't handle change very well?
See, there are these weird threads, but I was studying this a lot because we were talking about the effects of education on certain groups of people, in particular, like Native Americans during a certain time period of this country's history.
Right.
Where we were sending them to reform schools to make them more white and taking away their identity.
Yeah.
Well, now we have people who are those descendants who have all of this inherited genetic trauma and are inheriting all these diseases from things that happened to them. So there's like this whole movement towards cultural foodways coming back in the Native American community because of all of these like heart diseases and diabetes that were never, ever part of their community. But when the U.S. only gave them lard and white flour as rations, you know, so there's all of these kind of connections. And if you dive deep into that, you can see some you know, weird connections to things.
Yeah.
But for this particular person, I was like, I don't know about that. That's an interesting theory, but I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't know about that either.
It's definitely worth, like, looking into, especially on your own personal level. Like, as I started to look at my ancestral tree, I'm like, all of these things make sense now. Like, the abuses towards people of, you know, minority groups and women in my family. Right. I understand why, you know, certain people reacted the way they did through lineages. I get it now. Yeah. I'm pretty woke, as they say.
Girl, no.
I'm woke to my own being.
No.
Anyway, back to Felt Dubs and Mamet. So Taliesin was Wright's ultimate pet project. It was, you could say, a labor of love. Do you have an anti-hype button that you can push?
A negative hype button?
Yeah.
No. Unfortunately, I don't.
So he constructed this monstrosity out of love and would continue to tinker with the design the rest of his life. He would go back and keep trying to update it and make it better. The original structure was a low-wide, sprawling prairie-style mansion made of yellow limestone bricks. The plaster walls were tinted with sienna pigment, which gave it this kind of golden hue. So very much kind of copying the colors of the prairie.
I was going to say, it's a very Midwestern style, for
sure. There were banks of windows, like, in every single room. So there was lots and lots of natural sunlight, and they didn't really have to put electricity in. So that's really nice. The exterior walls had shingles that were colored specifically to age to a gray that resembled the surrounding tree line. So he was really thinking about how the house inhabited where he was. The home also had no gutters, as Wright enjoyed the look of icicles dangling off the sides of the building. So he would purposefully design these roofs so that water would kind of stagnate to create icicles in the winter. Again, thinking about where he was.
I mean, that's pretty clever.
Yeah.
And that definitely does happen around here.
Oh, yeah. There was also a huge courtyard in the center and a vast garden filled with rhubarb and asparagus, as well as 1,000 fruit trees ranging from apples, pears, and plums.
Literal 1,000?
1,000 fruit trees.
Okay.
He wanted to actually move into this home and take less commissions and become a farmer.
Interesting.
Yeah. So he wanted to have a fruit farm. Obviously, that did not happen. So there's also a huge water garden stocked with fish, and Wright was beginning his obsession with Japanese aesthetics, so the design was very, like, a Japanese koi pond-esque kind of a feel. And this place was, like, not only designed as a love nest, but it was the testament of his design theory of organic architecture. So creating things that become one with the environment that they're in, which is why there's so many kind of colorways and illusions and structural pieces of the place that make it look just like the surrounding area. Mm-hmm. And the limestones come from that place. So all of these things, like, it becomes one with the, Midwestern landscape. Which is a great thought. I love the arts and crafts movement. I love his architecture. And I love that theory, but he is still a trash person. So now comes the very interesting story of murder. Let's talk more about architectural theory. Shared trauma. On August 15th, 1914, Wright was away in Chicago developing some plans for the Midway Gardens. That day, Mamet was visited by her two children, John, who was 11, and Martha, who was 9. The house was buzzing with a great deal of workers. Draftsman Herbert Fritz, draftsman Emile Brodel, foreman William Weston and his 13-year-old son Ernest, and laborer Thomas Brunker. Then there was gardener David Lindblom, who was kind of out and about. But all the other people were kind of like in the house working. This wasn't common. This, like, was super common for all of these people to be there all the time, even if he was not there.
Yeah.
He constantly had workers starting on projects and finishing things for him while he was working on larger pieces. So not uncommon for all of these people to be at home. Now, there was also the cooks, Julian and Gertrude Carlton. The Carltons had only been working for the Wrights for a few months. The two were recommended to Wright by a business associate from the Midway Gardens project. The Carltons had come up from Chicago for the job and were touted as very experienced, exceptional cooks. There is little known about their exact background, but it is estimated that Julian was originally from Alabama and that his family originally came from Barbados or the West Indies. They're not 100% positive. He was kind of separated from his family. The Carltons had their difficulties working there. Being the only African-Americans within hundreds of miles was kind of a daunting task.
Yeah, of course, right?
Julian wanted to leave only after 2 weeks at the residence. Around August 1st, Julian told his wife he was attending a dentist appointment in Madison because they were out in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. A day or so later, he sent a telegram to her from Chicago and gave no explanation as to why he was in Chicago and not Madison, or if he was even at a dentist appointment.
Weird.
So a little strange.
Yeah.
A few days after that, he returned and said nothing to her.
Wow.
Didn't mention it. Nothing.
Okay.
Then, on August 5th, Carlton went into town to buy muriatic acid from a druggist.
This is all very suspicious.
Muriatic acid. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Then, on August 11th, Carlton had a confrontation with Emile Brodel, who was a worker, when he refused to saddle a horse for him. Now, Brodel began screaming at him and called him a name, but not the name you're thinking. He called him a black son of a bitch. And so this was kind of the thought that really was like, okay, he wanted to leave. This is the, you know, straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak.
Right,
is done with this place.
Yeah.
On the morning of August 15th, Carlton went in around the house cleaning and kind of doing his duties and asked where the gasoline was because he was going to clean a stained rug with it.
Okay.
Okay. So he's going around asking people where the gas can was that they have because he's going to clean a stained rug. Right?
Okay.
You clean rugs with gasoline all the time.
Yep. That's my go-to trick.
I mean, if you're
burning that rug. I saw it on Instagram that it works perfect.
Now, meanwhile, Carlton had told his wife, Gertrude, to obtain train tickets to Chicago, and he was putting his notice in to leave. So she went off to go get tickets while he's, like, going to finish cleaning. This is when a spree began.
Okay.
Since it was lunchtime, everyone was in their respective quarters to dine. Mamay was with her two children in the courtyard for lunch. This is where Carlton would strike first. Mamay would be struck in the back of the skull with a roofing hatchet.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Next would be her son and then daughter. There is no evidence that the kids even ran away. They were all kind of just in the same area.
Right.
In the courtyard.
Right.
And it was like a one strike blow down for the count.
Of course.
Now, he then coated the bodies in gasoline and set them on fire. Mm-hmm. Carlton would then move on to the other workers in the home. He set fire to the interior of the house closest to the workrooms so as to block the people in cause a one-way path for them to escape.
That's terrible.
Herbert Fritz saw the fire and broke the window and jumped from it. He would break one of his legs.
I guess that's better than dying.
Dying of fire.
Although
or a
in the 1920s, is breaking a leg really better?
I don't know. It's a toss up.
Yeah.
Julian would then enter the adjacent dining room. So these are all kind of connected through weird doorway systems and kill Emile Brodel, the man who had yelled at him not but a few days earlier. Then he would go on to foreman William Weston and his 13-year-old son, Ernest. Now, they were kind of out of the drafting room, and all of a sudden, he came upon them with a hatchet. Mm-hmm. They fought back and escaped the house, but they would not come away unscathed. They had severe wounds from the hatchet. Ernest would die a few days later from these wounds, so the little 13-year-old boy passed away. Now, Brinker and Lindholm were next. The two both managed to fight off Carlton's attack, but again, they were so, you know, cut up, and they actually received really bad burns from trying to escape the room that was on fire that they, too, would die a few days later from the complications of their wounds. Carlton would then go down into the basement, and he stuffed himself inside of a furnace.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Yep. That's totally what you do. He had planned to kind of succumb to the fire. That was what he was going to do on his rampage and just sit in there and die. However, he did bring a backup plan just in case that didn't work. A bottle of acid to swallow.
Oh, my God. That's like really intense. All of that, even just those two things on their own.
Just you wait.
So intense to like do to yourself.
Now, he's in a fucking furnace, which is kind of like a fireproof fucking box.
Right.
So the fire did not become too much for him. He did not become overwhelmed by it. And so he swallowed the acid.
Oh, my God.
Now, The workers who were away a little bit had returned while the blaze was beginning, and they put out the blaze. So the house, the fire was out. Carlton was still down in the furnace, and he had swallowed the acid, but survived.
Oh, my God.
So when the sheriff got there, they found him. They located his ass, and they took him into custody and sent him to the Dodgeville jail. During his transport, it was reported that a mob was outside the jail ready to lynch him. And so they pulled him in and they locked him up, and they had like 24-hour surveillance so that they didn't have a lynching on their hands.
Yeah.
Now, while this was happening, his wife was found out in the middle of a field with all of her personal effects in a suitcase. And she said that he was, you know, she was waiting for him to return.
Mm-hmm.
That he was finishing up and then they were going to go on the train because she had bought tickets.
Yeah.
Well, that never happened.
Oh, my God.
So they decided to bring Gertrude in and interview her because this all sounded a little suspect, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
They conducted the interview, and Gertrude stated, "My husband had the notion that he was being pursued. He recently got to waking me up in the night at our quarters in the bungalow to listen for noises. He kept saying they were trying to get me. He would sometimes choke me in the night and threaten to knock my brains out. He would also take the hatchet to bed with him.
Oh, my God.
He forced me to tell Mrs. Brothwick that we were going to quit because I was lonesome." So that was her statement.
Okay.
So based upon that, you could see he was kind of becoming a little unhinged.
Yeah.
He felt like people were coming after him. To me, it sounded like maybe he was starting to suffer from a mental illness.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking, if there was some of that. Because, of course, it would go undiagnosed at that point.
Definitely. Yeah. Especially because of his status in society.
Right, yeah.
So there's a lot of tells in that, you know, going to bed with a weapon, saying that he was hearing things, becoming violent, having outbursts.
Yeah.
And reportedly, he was not a violent person.
Mm-hmm.
On August 27th, a continuance was issued due to Carlton's health because, you know, he swallowed fucking acid.
Jesus.
Julian Carlton was charged with just one death of Emile Burdell. Now, the prosecutors decided to do this as this was the only murder that had an eyewitness. And that would be the easiest to prosecute. So they only prosecuted him for the murder of Emile Burdell.
I mean, again, like in context of that time period.
Obviously, he killed all of those people.
Right.
But because one person survived and put him at the place of the crime, that's great.
Yeah.
There's no DNA at this time.
No.
There's no like fingerprinting that's going to really make any sense.
Fire science.
Yeah, and fire science is not a thing.
Not a thing.
They look at the charred remains and they go, there was a fire here. Yeah. That's the fire science of this time period. So that was kind of a big deal and something I thought was pretty interesting to the case. And usually a lot of times, in cases that are sensational as this, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright's involved. It's a servant killing people of a higher stature in their own home. They would want to deal with them to the fullest extent. But I think they were very diplomatic in this and wanted to truly seal the deal and not have any questions.
Yeah.
And so they only charged him with the one death. Now, on October 1st, the trial was set to begin, but the judge received word that the defendant was too weak to attend. So two physicians were called to examine him just to make sure that wasn't a bluff or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did swallow acid.
I cannot believe that he survived that.
Just wait. Just wait until you hear what happens.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, after they examined him later that morning, Carlton was carried into the judge's chambers by two officers.
Oh, my God, guys.
An attorney was then appointed to him, and a plea of not guilty was entered. Okay?
Okay.
What the fuck? The lawyer requested a slight delay in proceedings due to his client's health, which was granted, but the judge stated that they cannot wait too long. They wanted to get this taken care of.
Right.
On October 7th, Carlton died in his cell. The official cause was stated as starvation.
Oh, my God. No shit. Because he probably couldn't eat anything because he swallowed acid.
Because he had no fucking esophagus.
1900s logic.
So,
thank you. Guys.
Ultimately, I mean, he was trying to eat, but he was throwing stuff back up.
Right.
He could only have things that were
liquids.
Which
I'm sure only made it worse, too.
And how can you fix a throat
in
this time period? You can't.
Yeah.
There's no, like, throat surgery.
And there's no, like, alternative to getting sustenance. Mm-hmm. Like, you couldn't put a feeding tube in.
Exactly. That wasn't really a thing yet.
Yeah.
So that's why it was marked as starvation, not motherfucker swallowed a bottle of acid, you know.
Oh my God.
As they do. Now, the one topic of discussion on this case that's always brought up is, why the fuck did he do it? Why did he do it? It doesn't make sense. Why would you just start killing people and not just leave? And there are two possible theories outlined in a lot of the readings that I perused, particularly the book Death in a Prairie House. One of them being that he was just a madman, that he went crazy. He didn't feel he could escape his situation. So he went on a rampage to make sure that he could, you know, take down as many people as possible.
Right, right.
The other reason that was given was that he had become a religious zealot bent on eradicating the Sinley household.
No.
So that's the two main theories that were, like, proposed.
I'm going to put this out there and just say no.
Yes.
I think it's...
I do think
it's far more likely that he probably was suffering from some, like, maybe schizophrenia or something, which can very easily turn into something as horrible as this if it goes untreated.
So, I mean, based upon his wife's testimony and his age, because he was just beginning to get into his 30s.
Okay.
I think Carlton was going through an episode that resembles schizophrenia. That's the correct time. You know, that's the correct age. Usually schizophrenics don't begin to show until their late 20s, early 30s.
Right.
It starts with hallucinations or auditory things. Mm-hmm. So hearing things.
Mm-hmm.
Waking up in the middle of the night, very common. Taking out these sort of really weird rage-filled reactions on your significant other or another family member is also very common.
Ideas that you're being pursued or followed or watched
lots of paranoia. So I think schizophrenia is definitely it. The fact that none of his other employers that he had before this said anything about his behavior or had any issues with him whatsoever leads me to believe that it was something that was manifesting quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And especially being isolated in Wisconsin in an area of racial hostility and being the direct receiver of racial hostility would also add to it.
Yeah.
If you come at someone with schizophrenia in a combative way, it definitely intensifies that. So you see a lot of police training to deal with people with mental illness on the streets, because a lot of them do have schizophrenia that's untreated.
Yeah.
There's a lot of tactics in talking to them and becoming personable, especially in times when they are very, like, agitated and paranoid. And so that kind of reaction from that Emile Bredell fellow probably amplified that kind of paranoia and rage that he was feeling. It was definitely just, everything was just exacerbating his situation.
Right.
Whatever the case may be, he definitely fucking did it.
Yeah. Yeah. Not disputing that here. Nope.
There is a really great article that I put in there that I think really has a magnificent way of kind of putting this whole situation. It was like, Love House, scene of murder at the hand of infuriated colored servant, soulmate to Frank Lloyd Wright and her two children victims, hatchet used by maddened Negro.
Okay, guys.
So
God
that,
damn.
I think,
God damn it.
That, I think, really shows what him and his wife were dealing with, right?
Yeah.
They were, you know, it probably wasn't thought about, obviously, the time period being what it was, but having someone who has a mental illness and being in such a hostile environment, the newspaper calling out all of these things. And I know that they do that to be sensational, but I think it's poignant in understanding this weird reaction of him wanting to murder a bunch of people.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's wild, man.
But,
I can definitely see how he would be much more easily agitated, because I'm sure it was literally racism every day being surrounded by all of these white people that...
And some of them consider themselves to be enlightened, obviously, not so enlightened.
Yeah.
I'm sure... So, in a lot of the literature and things that Mamet was, you know, going through, there was a lot of talk about race relations and, and that. And I don't believe that the rage that he took out on them was necessarily directly related to that.
No.
I think it was kind of just a complete annihilation situation.
Yeah.
I'm sure he probably had issues with working for them. You know, mm-hmm. it's a 24-hour job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're on call all the time.
Yeah.
You're having to serve lunch to one person and then another lunch, completely different lunch in a different place to another person. Like, there's a lot of things that you have to take into consideration.
Yeah.
But there's a picture at the bottom of the house after the fire.
Damn.
So it was fucking tore up from the floor up. Frank Lloyd Wright would rebuild it.
Okay.
And eventually he would move in there with another woman.
Oh, my God. Okay. Come on,
and
dude.
So there is a Taliesin II. And that eventually would catch on fire again.
Oh, my God.
There was an electrical issue, though. Look. Someone terrible didn't look. Set it on fire on purpose this time. There was an electrical issue, and Taliesin II also caught on fire.
Okay.
This is kind of towards
did
the end.
Did he do a Taliesin III?
He did.
Oh, my God.
It was towards the end of his life, and he wanted to get it cleaned up enough so that it could become a monument to his architectural philosophy.
Okay.
You can visit the Taliesin.
Where is that at?
It's up in Wisconsin.
Okay.
It's a museum. You can go on an architectural tour. You can see his studio.
Yeah.
They have original pictures of the building, which I have in here, too. There's mm-hmm. not a whole lot because most of the things were destroyed in one of two of the fires.
Of course.
The first fire destroyed a lot of the home. The second fire destroyed most of his studio, so there were things lost. He did move a great portion of his papers and files out after that because he finally got a fucking clue. Maybe my houses catch on fire all the
time.
Maybe
my important stuff should not be kept in the most flammable area of my life.
But he created a trust to save this in a couple other places. There's his studio, like you mentioned, visiting his studio. Mm-hmm. That's another trusted place where you can go visit. But a lot of the homes that he created, you can visit. And it is worth a while to go and see and check out.
Oh, totally, totally.
The architectural movement is beautiful. It's great. I love it. He is a person, not so much.
Yeah. This is definitely one of those times where you have to separate the art from the artist mm-hmm. because the artist was a piece of shit, but the work produced.
He didn't directly murder anybody. He didn't directly rape anybody.
He was directly a piece of shit.
He used women, but not. He wasn't violent towards. He just loved to sleep with.
He just loved a bevy of women.
But he had deep seated issues, and also that happens when you're an artist. You just have this sort of arrogance about you, I guess. If you're a male artist in particular, we'll just put it that way. Of this time period.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
But yeah, I mean, it's definitely worth going to see. I plan on going to go up there in the summer.
Nice. Yeah.
It's a little bit pricey for a tour, but you get to go across the entire fucking landscape of this place.
Yeah.
There's also one in Rockford called the Laurent House. That one, I think, is I've been in there. It's a beautiful mid-century modern home. It's fucking gorgeous. They have a bunch of original stuff in there.
Yeah.
That's a really great place to take a tour as well. Nice. You can hit up the main ones, but those are like, you know, that's like a nice hidden gem. Mm-hmm. And then the Taliesin is like the ultimate culminating testament to his architecture.
Yeah, yeah.
But that is FL Dubs and Mame and the
thanks
fucking
for that.
Taliesin
that was very
murders.
Interesting. I
it's
loved
a roller
it.
Coaster. Mm.
Okay, I'm very excited about this.
It's one of your favorite topics.
It is, it really is. I got to combine one of your favorite topics with one of my favorite topics. Yes. So I'm going to be discussing the murder of Ellie Perkins. She was born Ellie Present and was originally from a Jewish family. And eventually, Ellie met a contractor named Don who had been raised Christian. Ellie was an artist that specialized in artwork that was hand-painted in glass. So it's kind of like those little stained glass kind of things, mm-hmm. but it's all hand-painted. According to the original website for their company called Glass Art.
Classy name.
I mean, says what it does
to
on the
fucking point.
Yeah. Ellie attended Rochester Institute of Technology Art School, where she was trained in glass painting and, quote, found herself inspired by the ethereal qualities of glass, which best reflect her love of the realm of fairy.
That sounds like so many middle-aged women I know.
And she definitely, I think at the time that she was studying art and starting to work on this glass stuff, it was very much that kind of hippie, like finding yourself, enlightenment kind of thing. 'Cause this would have been during the like 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. Her artwork appeared in many places, including Japan, England, Israel, and Russia. And she spent the summer showcasing her artwork at the Sterling New York Renaissance Festival.
Mm, a Ren Fair.
A Ren Fair. I think it was more of like an art festival.
Can I just pretend it's like the Ren Fair?
You can. Yeah, just a Ren Fair, but with
turkey legs
more
and glass.
Yes. I just imagine somebody with like a turkey leg, like in a gallery.
Could you imagine a stained glass piece of a turkey leg? That'd be amazing.
Oh my god, that would be something. In an excerpt from Metro Community News article titled "Ex-Hippies Turn Successful Businesswomen,"
you can too.
Yeah, and this is from 1995.
You know, I'm not surprised. That weird like hippie resurgence in the 90s.
Yes. And well, and this was very much like, look at how this hippie has turned her life around. Like, that was kind of the idea. Mm-hmm. So this is just an excerpt from that article. Quote, "It's a long way from Woodstock to Williamsville."
Oh boy.
"And it had been a lengthy journey for Ellie Present Perkins of Hopkins Road from the streets of Haight-Ashbury to the malls of local suburbia, where sales of her glass sun catchers have made her one of the richest ex-hippies in Western New York. Here they are. This is my collection. This 5'1" mother of two recently announced with a satisfied grin, pointing to her current stock of the mostly 11-inch by 14-inch rectangular glass renderings of animals, rural scenes, and assorted plant life, which have made her a successful housewife entrepreneur over the past 16 years.
I'm just going to put it out there that I'm not a fan of stained glass.
You would not be a fan of this at all.
Yeah.
Because it's very...
mom art.
Yeah, and like craft fairy. Mm-hmm.
I have no
stuff.
Problem with crafts. Like, I love
no, but
love
it's something
craft,
that a mom would make and then take to a craft fair and sell for way too much money, like very much.
There's
so I don't know. Did I put
with
her
the
website
art world?
In? Yeah, I will have
I mean,
to show
you.
You
do you. You sell your art. You get it
right.
But I just there's something about. Like that whole like nature scene, arts and crafts movement that I want to hit my head against a wall.
So when Ellie and Don met, it was shortly after that Ellie had taken her first Scientology course.
Man, stained glass and Scientology. Mm-hmm. You really have it all.
Yeah. And she, from what I can understand, I mean, obviously... And
I mean,
we'll
they,
get into,
look, they search out entrepreneurs. So I get
they
it.
Do. They do search out entrepreneurs, and we'll get into this a little bit later. But from what I could tell, when she wasn't doing Scientology stuff, she still was working on artwork and doing that whole thing. But obviously, as you get
did
into
she
the
make an L. Ron Hubbard stained
no,
glass. Oh
no,
God,
that would have been amazing
have.
Though.
Quick, somebody Google that.
I would not be surprised if it exists somewhere.
Love it.
Although the guy is not exactly the most photogenic, but that's fine. The way that Ellie tells it, she had been on this journey to really find her place in the world, and this hippie mentality really ended when a boyfriend of hers was admitted to a psychiatric hospital for drug addiction.
You say tomato, I say mushrooms.
Yeah, right. It's hard to say what pulled her into Scientology at the time, but in modern day, most people are pulled into Scientology via body routers, which is what they call the people who are like stationed on the street offering the free personality tests or like handing out brochures. Like those are body routers. They're
I
supposed
love
to route
a good
people.
Personality test.
Yeah, it is, by the way, not just a personality test. It's a personality and an IQ test, and they do them back to back, and it's like 4 or 5 hours of your time. So
that
heads up on that.
Fucking ridiculous.
Yeah. So it's possible, like, and that's the other thing with these personality tests. When they bring you in, the thing at the end is a pitch for Scientology
of
courses.
Course. Yeah.
So it's possible that something similar to this was happening in the 90s, but it's hard to say. I couldn't really figure out like what the mitigating factor was that like brought her in. It's also possible that she found some of like Hubbard's old writings. L. Ron Hubbard, for those that don't know who I'm talking about.
L.R.H.
Yeah, the creator and founder of Scientology. You know what the L stands for?
What?
Lafayette.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Gross.
I know. It's pretty bad. Lafayette Ron Hubbard.
Not the L. Ron?
No.
He's L. Ron. No.
He's gross.
Let's yeah, I know. I've seen pictures of him. Although, you know, I like a good sci-fi novel.
True. Yeah, that... don't even get me started. That's the whole point. That's the whole reason Scientology exists, but yep. That's another story for another time.
Yes. another 8-hour episode we have to do.
Yes. Oh, my God. So, it's entirely possible like she found some of his writings and they just sparked her interest and she's like, maybe I should check out the Scientology thing. Either way, both she and her husband Don joined the church and then credited their use of Scientology for the success of their art business. Mm-hmm. Not long after getting married, Ellie and Don had two kids, Jeremy, who was born in 1975, and Danielle, born in 1976. While raising their kids, Ellie and Don continued the long, arduous journey through Scientology, doing various auditing sessions, and then they eventually gained the status of clear in 1979. So I tried really hard to kind of like take out all of the, but there is some things I need explaining if you're going to understand this. Yeah. So you go into Scientology, you do these courses. The whole point is you're working your way up the bridge to clear, which means you are clear of like engrams. You're at that point moving on to the OT levels. And OT means operating Thetan. That's kind of like your when you're supposed to have like perfect recall and not get sick anymore and like all that fun stuff. OT is also where you learn about Xenu and the aliens and all that fun stuff too. So per the Scientology website, what is Scientology.org?
Cool.
Yep. Auditing is defined as, quote, Scientology counseling taken from the Latin word audere, which means to hear or listen. Auditing is a very unique form of personal counseling, which helps an individual to look at his own existence and improves his ability to confront what he is and where he is. And a clear is a highly desirable state for the individual achieved through auditing, which was never attainable before Dianetics. A clear is a person who no longer has his own reactive mind and therefore suffers none of the ill effects that the reactive mind can cause. The clear has no engrams, which, when re-stimulated, throw out of the correctness of his computations by entering hidden and false data. Okay. I'm doing this just in case some of you, like, yes, don't know Scientology speak. So, soon after achieving this clear status, which, like I said, isn't the end. It just means you move on to the OT levels.
There is no end.
There actually is literally no end. There's still, I think, a couple OT levels that still have to come out yet that haven't.
And they never will
probably. The Perkins family, they moved from New York to California, where Ellie started working at the Celebrity Center for a little point in time before returning to New York. Okay, so there is a little bit of Scientology history I have to provide here for some context for the events that are going to eventually perspire. So according to Scientology.org, this is what modern day Scientology has to say about their views on psychiatry and psychology. Mm-hmm. So this is actually in the FAQ. Of their website. It says, why is Scientology opposed to psychiatric abuses? And I'm not going to go through all of this, but the Scientology objection to psychiatry does not stem from any desire to deny the insane treatment. Rather, the church objects to the mistreatment of the insane, which is psychiatry's historical hallmark. That is why the church supports the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, which is a Scientology organization, which works to expose and eradicate the brutalization of parents in the name of, quote, mental health. Over the years, the Citizens Commission has investigated and exposed thousands upon thousands of cases of psychiatric negligence, abuse, and brutality. So it goes on.
You're totally wrong. There are some people who do abuse the system a bit, but
there
not
is
for what the purpose they're saying it is for.
Right. So I mean, they go on to say, like, today the marketing of antidepressants has likewise reached nightmarish proportions, and the scenario becomes even more disturbing when one considers the explosively violent episode such drug prescriptions or such drugs precipitate. And then, anyway, it's a whole thing.
I mean, to be honest, I went to a doctor when I was a teenager, and they mm-hmm. kept telling me that I had depression, and I didn't.
Yeah.
I had anxiety, which is a different thing.
Okay.
And they prescribed me an antidepressant, which did the reverse that it's supposed to. That's what happens when you give the wrong drugs to the wrong people.
Sure.
So I can understand where they're coming from.
Right.
Because I have experienced that.
Yeah. But once you got it fixed.
That is very, very, very rare.
Yeah. And I was going to say, once you got it fixed, did it help?
I mean, I didn't have to take any medicine.
Right. So
they're like, take these pills. And I took them for a month. And I go, they ain't
not
what I'm feeling.
Yeah, but like you said, that's not like
very, very rare. And I was also a teenager, which you're not supposed to give those to teenagers, which is a whole nother thing that was wrong.
Yes. Oh my
you're
gosh.
Not supposed to give those off to people who are under 18. Okay?
Yeah, well. So I've always found Hubbard's stance on psychiatry really interesting because much of Dianetics is actually derived from some psychological theories, as well as Hubbard's own claims of working in places such as Oaknall Hospital during the development of Dianetics. According to John Atack's book, Piece of Blue Sky, Scientology, Dianetics, and L. Ron Hubbard Exposed, which is a fantastic...
very long title.
It is, yeah. Piece of Blue Sky is what you need to look for, but it is a fantastic book on Scientology. It is like, John Atack is kind of considered the premier like Scientology expert. He was really the first one to kind of put together all of these volumes of what it is and how it works and the history and all of that kind of stuff. So definitely check it out. I know I've brought it up on the show before, but that's because it's very good. So according to that book by John Atack, he says, quote, it was claimed that through Dianetics, the individual would be freed of psychoses and neuroses. Among the psychosomatic conditions Dianetics claimed to cure were asthma, poor eyesight, color blindness, hearing deficiencies, stuttering, allergies, sinusitis, arthritis, high blood pressure, coronary trouble, dermatitis, ulcers, migraine, conjunctivitis, morning sickness, alcoholism, and the common cold. Even tuberculosis would be alleviated.
I mean, it can do it all.
Atack also points out that much of the basis for the therapy was, quote, a reworking of ideas abandoned by Freud in favor of the interpretation of dreams. He later goes on to say in Dianetics, the modern science of mental health, which is this piece of Dianetics that Hubbard put out. Freudian ideas were presented in a new elaborate language. Dianetics differed by approaching the general public directly rather than through the psychiatric or psychological professions. Dianetics also completely avoided libido theory, the interpretation of dreams, transference, and complex Freudian evaluations. But for whatever reason, maybe because like psychiatry is such a direct competitor to Dianetics, at least it was when it first came out, it seems that the church's stance got a little bit more bitter and angry later on when this was like post Hubbard going into hiding because the government was after him. And this is, let's see, this is from a Hubbard Communications Office policy letters. So they were releasing all these policy letters to kind of run things from where he was hiding at. It was titled, it was series 12 titled Propaganda by Redefinition of Words. Okay. So this is a direct from L. Ron Hubbard.
It's all just cyclical nonsense.
Direction. It is. Yeah. So this is from Hubbard's own mouth. Quote, psychiatry and psychiatrist are easily redefined to mean an antisocial enemy of the people. This takes the kill crazy psychiatrist off the preferred list of professions. The redefinition of words is done by associating different emotions and symbols with the word that were intended. Scientologists are redefining doctor, psychiatry, and psychology to mean undesirable antisocial elements. The way to redefine a word is to get the new definition repeated as often as possible. Thus, it is necessary to redefine medicine, psychiatry, and psychology downward and define Dianetics and Scientology upward. This, so far as words are concerned, is a public opinion battle for belief in your definitions and not those of the opposition. A consistent, repeated effort is the key to any success with this technique of propaganda.
Yikes.
So this is about when they were just like totally anti-psychiatry, psychology, any of that. Okay. So back to the Perkins family. Sorry, that was all like, if you know nothing about Scientology, this will all make sense now that you know all of that very basic Scientology knowledge. So Jeremy Perkins, which was the eldest son, was leading a seemingly normal life and had dreams of becoming a rock drummer.
As you do.
As you do. Some folks describe him as somebody who would, like, do anything for you. Just a very kind guy. In early adulthood, he lived at home and worked for his father's contracting business and helping his mom with her glass painting business on the side. It wasn't until he was 24 that people began noticing kind of, like, strange behavior from Jeremy. As you were going through yours, I was like, ours are so similar, in fact. Anyway. So he told a friend and his father that he was hearing voices, and the solution, his father told him, was tell the voices to stop.
I mean, sometimes you need to be direct with them.
Just stop, guys.
Hey, guys. Give me a minute here.
but obviously, I mean, this is clearly not something that worked or would have worked, no matter
probably,
how hard they tried.
Probably not recommended.
And instead, Ellie and Don opted to send Jeremy they decided to send him into the Sea Org at that point in time, because...
As you do.
Yeah, and the Sea Organization... Hold on, I might go into it here after that.
Makeshift Navy.
Yeah, so...
Quotes on the Navy.
They were hoping that the strict requirements of the Sea Org would, like, get him into shape, so to speak. Mm-hmm. If you've never heard about... Like, if you guys have ever heard about the billion-year contracts, the Sea Organization is where those are signed. That's, like, the serious shit is the Sea Org. Yes, also a quote-unquote Navy.
Yet no one knows how to drive a boat.
Right. And like, you have to, the billion-year contract, you have to sign that before you become a part of the organization. And that's where a lot of people come into issues when they're trying to leave Scientology. Mm-hmm. And all that fun stuff.
Are you at a billion years? No. Back on the boat.
Before the end of the year, however, Jeremy was rejected from the organization. According to CBS's 48 Hours, he was rejected for what was perceived to be increasingly bizarre behavior.
That's got to be pretty fucking strange for this organization.
So he returned home and continued working for his father. But for obvious reasons, his hallucinations and delusions only got worse and worse as time went on, because they were going untreated. Mm-hmm. It wasn't long before he was labeled a PTS, which is a potential trouble source. And those are, like, the people you gotta watch and report on. Mm-hmm. Ellie and Don took him to a series of doctors, some that did CAT scans at the family's request, claiming the hallucinations were a result of some sort of accident in a truck in 2002. But none of the CAT scans found anything. And these doctors were like, no, really, this isn't because of this accident. You need to take him to a psychologist. So they suggested taking Jeremy to a psychiatrist, which, of course, is a request that the Perkins would not honor. And it seems like the only steps they actually took was filling a prescription for the sleeping pill Sonata, which obviously didn't help.
Yeah, I don't think you could just sleep off schizophrenia.
Sleep off the voices? Is that how that works? On August 14th, Jeremy was caught trespassing on the University of Buffalo campus. When he was confronted by police, he began fighting back, resulting in his arrest. One court ordered psychiatric exam later, and it was confirmed that Jeremy was schizophrenic.
Called it.
Right. He was remanded into the custody of a hospital, where he stayed for a few days before Ellie managed to convince the facility to release him. Yay.
No.
He later went to a neurologist that again confirmed the diagnosis of schizophrenia.
As if you didn't know.
you might be schizophrenic.
Yep. But Ellie and Don refuse to place Jeremy on psychotic medications due to the conflict with Scientology beliefs. Yeah, I know. It's
almost as bad as people not vaccinating their children.
I know. So for most of the remaining summer, the Perkins continued to seek out a treatment without disobeying the practice of Scientology. And according, again, to 48 Hours, it came to a point where Jeremy was sleeping in a chair outside of his parents' bedroom because he believed that there were aliens in his bedroom.
But only his bedroom.
Only his. Nowhere else. Okay. Yeah. In the fall, the Perkinses took Jeremy, who at this point was 27, to a Scientologist and osteopath, Dr. Conrad Malfair, who promoted natural drug-free healing.
Yep.
So that's
naturopathy
a thing.
For schizophrenia.
He was Scientology approved.
It works.
Yeah, totally. Again, from 48 Hours, quote, Nun Chirino says Malfair's clinic had an unusual explanation for Jeremy's symptoms. They conclude that he was suffering from certain digestive problems, that he had certain chemical toxins in his body, and he needed to be purged of it, and he needed to be energized through vitamin therapy, which vitamin therapy is a big thing also in Scientology. When you do a what is it called? I forget what it's called. There's like a seminar process thing that you do where you do a lot of running, take a lot of niacin, more running, a lot of niacin.
I thought it was going to be like a B12 shot.
There's some vitamin in there that you take too. It's a whole thing.
Oh my God.
The purification rundown. That's what it's called. Purif. The purification rundown.
Yep. I get it because the running.
Well, I don't know about that, but so that's what his Scientology doctor thought.
Oh boy.
Purge of the toxins, take some vitamins, and your schizophrenia will be good. So they went with
never there in the first place.
So they went with the vitamins,
of course,
and it
can't hurt.
It was a treatment that didn't work.
Huh?
Are you shocked?
Yeah.
Instead, Jeremy only became increasingly more aggressive and suspicious that Ellie might be trying to poison him.
Yeah, I'd say making me run a bunch and take niacin.
Yeah, he didn't do that part of it, mm-hmm. but they definitely like put him on a bunch of vitamins and like yeah. So in February 2003, Ellie and Jeremy went to the home of self-taught natural healer named Albert Brown, who asked Jeremy if he thought he had any problems. His response was, quote, "Sometimes I think I'm Jesus Christ."
Only sometimes?
Sometimes. It was decided that Jeremy would move into Brown's house the following month for treatment, and while he was packing for the trip on March 13, 2003, Ellie and Jeremy got into an argument that Don had come home from work to like diffuse. Mm-hmm. After he left and returned to work, Ellie told Jeremy to get in the shower. That is the point when Jeremy attacked his mother. According to Jeremy, in a statement given to police, quote, "When I got out of the shower, I saw that my mom was on the phone in the kitchen. I went into the kitchen and took a pointed knife around 12 inches long with a brown handle. I held the knife in my right hand and behind my back. And when she hung up the phone, I tried to slit my wrist after the shower with a utility knife, but I wouldn't die, so I decided to do my mom in instead. I pushed her into my bedroom downstairs and stabbed her in the chest and right arm. She was screaming, 'No, don't, Jeremy, don't.' I stabbed her about 4 to 5 times before she fell down. I was using a cross-stabbing motion while she was standing. I then stabbed her about 10 more times in the stomach after she fell to the ground. I knew she was a goner. I then tried to cut her right eyeball out a bit. It would not come out. I believed her eyes were evil. I took the knife into the kitchen, cleaned it up in the sink, and dropped it onto the floor. I pulled the phone cord out of the wall. I was going to put the knife and my mom in the basement to hide her. We have a fallout shelter down there, but my neighbor Sharon came over, so I hid in my bedroom. I did not want her to know what I did because I liked her a lot. A short time later, a police officer came and asked me where my mother was. I let the officer in and showed him where she was. I told the officer someone must have broken into the house and did this. I then was transported to the police headquarters where I was given my rights. I told the detectives what I did and why. I have been getting angrier and angrier with my mom because of the way she treats me. She gets mad at me when I play my drums in my room, and she makes me take these vitamins every day. When she made me take the shower this morning, that was the last straw. I believe I have lived different lives for the past 1,000 years and wished I was in another life now. According to an autopsy following her murder, it was determined Ellie was stabbed 77 times.
The difficult thing about listening to that is that he was, like, really cognizant of the fact that he did something wrong and was trying to hide it.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because he was, like, and it wasn't, the thing is, though, is he wasn't, it seemed to me, trying to hide it because he thought he was going to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. He didn't want this friend of theirs to find out because he liked her. Mm-hmm. And, like, it wasn't that it would, it's more like she would be disappointed in me, mm-hmm. not like I'm going to get in trouble and go to jail.
Yeah.
So it was, and even, like, even the last couple of things, like, I thought her eyes were evil. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to cut out one of her eyes. Mm-hmm. And I believe I've lived different lives for the past 1,000 years, which is a Scientology thing. That's, like,
yeah,
some of this past, they have some past life stuff mixed in there. Yeah. It was just very brutal. Very brutal.
Yeah, that's definitely rage-filled in the description. Mm-hmm.
Jeremy was arrested and charged with second-degree murder and fourth-degree criminal possession of a weapon, and he was immediately put on antipsychotic medication following his arrest, along with the obligatory psych evals. A 2003 eval indicates that Jeremy suffered from chronic paranoid schizophrenia that went entirely untreated. And then in July of 2003, Jeremy was found not responsible by reason of mental disease or defect. He was placed on 6 months probation, but the judge ordered yet another psychiatric examination to, quote, determine whether he has a dangerous mental disorder, and if the said defendant does not have a dangerous mental disorder, to determine whether he is mentally ill. Those examinations were done by the Rochester Psychiatric Center in January 2004. And this is what they found. Quote, the defendant has a dangerous mental disorder in that the defendant currently suffers from an affliction with a mental disease or mental condition, which is manifested by disorder or disturbance in behavior, feeling, thinking, or judgment to such an extent that the defendant requires care, treatment, and rehabilitation, and that because of such a condition, the defendant currently constitutes a physical danger to himself and others. Furthermore, they stated his psychosis had never been treated with antipsychotic medications, and it appears he was acutely psychotic at the time of the offense. In the period preceding this, he had been sleeping on a couch in the living room because he feared there was an alien ship in the ceiling of his bedroom. On the morning of the offense, his parents threatened to take him to Albert's place, and he was scared of this because of paranoid fear towards others who lived there. He felt his mother's face had an evil grin and her eyes were evil. In fact, during the offense, he attempted to remove his mother's eye, responding to psychotic thought processes. The report at this time said he continued to experience auditory hallucinations along with some other symptoms, but he had dramatically improved once he started taking medication, mm-hmm. like big time. However, he still thought that there was the alien living in the ceiling of his bedroom. Yeah. He still thought he had lived thousands of past lives and some of those things. But, like, his behavior had gone from being really erratic to, like, not as much. Mm-hmm. Who'd have thought? Mm-hmm. Get treated.
Huh.
Things get sort of better. After all of this, the courts determined that he must be committed to a state hospital. Of course, there was quite the panic within the church following Ellie's murder, and they quickly moved to, like, distance themselves from Jeremy Perkins, mm-hmm. as they do.
Yeah.
although he himself...
They do a hard nose goes.
Oh, for real. I mean, they were, like, instantly, they had people from OSA, which is the Office of... I would have to... It's like they're kind of, like... handling hazard,
gotcha.
Office. Yeah. It's kind of like the I think they might have renamed it to the, I think it might be the Guardian office now. But they're kind of, yeah, they're kind of the enforcers is a good way to say it. Like they were calling some people to be like, don't talk to anybody unless it's the police that come to talk to you, and tried to quiet everything down and then distance. And then, yeah, Jeremy himself has never actually blamed the church for what happened. Although his father and his sister, from what I can tell, continue to remain in the Church of Scientology. And of course, Ellie's murder has not swayed the organization's opinion of psychiatry as a quote unquote pseudoscience. This was also post Lisa McPherson's death, and which had just happened like a couple years before, like 3 or 4 years before. And she ended up dying after suffering from a mental break and being put into essentially solitary. So I think after that, they had some things in place to kind of like quiet everything down. You know,
they're really good at that.
But again, unfortunately, the undiagnosis of mental illness led to a break, essentially, that killed what potentially could have been a wonderful artist.
Yeah.
So
basically, that. Scientology kills.
In so many words.
That's what you're trying to say.
In so many words, yes. So if you need something to get your mind off of murder.
In this terrible world we live in.
And maybe see some beauty in it. Check out this podcast.
Hey, Linda.
Hey, Louise.
What's wrong?
Well, I love podcasts, but I need a new one. Do you know if there are any where two sweetie sisters talk about movies from the 80s and 90s that shape their childhood existence, and also that have a cat that makes a ruckus in the background?
Do I? Let me tell you a podcast I started listening to called Large Marge Sent Us. Two sisters break down classic 80s and 90s movies like The Princess Bride, Neverending Story, and Pee-wee's Big Adventure. They even did a whole month dedicated to Fred Savage flicks.
Wow, I love Fred Savage. Where can I get this magical podcast?
You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or Google Play. You can also follow them on Twitter at The Sweetie Club. And don't forget to tell them Large Marge sent you to this podcast.
Okay, Janelle. We've got a comment. Is that what you said?
We have a new Patreon new supporter.
Yeah.
So welcome to the BT crew, Michelle Guess, our
welcome.
New Patreon supporter.
Welcome, welcome.
If you're interested in donating and becoming part of our family, head on over to our Patreon. We have some great backlogged episodes. We are putting out a new series called Cocktails and Conspiracies, where I regale
gonna be so fun.
A cocktail and a conspiracy to my boyfriend Bo, and he screams in outrage over how fucked everything is.
You can find that at thebadtastecrimecast.com/donate.
Yes.
That'll take you right there. We've also, it's not too late to get some merch for those last minute forgotten shoppers. I mean, like forgotten gift receivers.
Yeah.
The people you forgot to buy for.
Yeah. Some people don't celebrate Christmas until after the 25th. It's totally fine.
Me. I'm always that one that's like, you know, you guys get your gifts after the first. Right? but you can go right on over to badtastecrimecast.com/merch, and we have hoodies and pencil cases. You just posted a pencil case picture. It looked cool.
Yeah. They do a great job printing our stuff.
And some stickers, I think.
Yep. All kinds of
stuff. So you can find that all there. What else? Keep an eye out for some stuff that's... Oh! We actually do have an event that we can announce.
Yeah.
So on July 11th, I want to say?
Through the 13th?
I think it's just a one day.
Well, they have something going on Friday evening, Saturday, and Sunday morning.
Friday evening is just for podcasters.
Is it just for podcasters?
To set up.
Yeah. Well, they will be announcing the full schedule on what's happening over the weekend, but it's now multiple days.
Yes. So July 11th and 12th. We'll say 11th and 12th. Janelle and I and our sound producer, Tiff, we are going to be in Kansas City, Missouri for the True Crime Podcast Festival 2020. Tickets are available now at tcpf2020.com. So head on over there for more information. There's already a ton of podcasts signed up.
Yeah.
I am so excited to like go on the road.
Is the place actually finished?
It's not. But we're staying in an Airbnb. So it's fine.
They're like, it will be at a hotel that will exist.
Yeah. It'll be like, it's literally opening in January, I think.
Yeah.
So hopefully it's finished. So it'll be like brand spanking new. Mm-hmm. But
you can break her in.
If you guys want to meet us, meet a lot of other cool shows. There are going to be some live shows. There are going to be some discussion panels. There's going to be lots of stuff going on this weekend. So you can check that out at tcpf2020.com.
Yes.
I want to say 2019 because that was last year's, but it's not. It's next year's.
Whole new website, whole new year.
Other than that, I think that's about it, right? Mm-hmm. All right. Our sound producer is Tiff Fullman. Mm-hmm. Our music is by Jason Sakshevsky, The Enigma. That was my Christmas present from Tiff. It's a hype button. I think she did that so she doesn't have to edit it in anymore. So really, it's a Christmas present for her.
It is.
We will see you in 2 weeks. Have a great new year.
Welcome to 2020, the end of the world.
Start setting everything on fire. Actually, don't do that. Please don't. Over this town. We are all evil in some form or another. Oh my god. This button.